Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And welcome back to another spine-tingling episode of Extreme Genes, America's family history show on ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher, the radio root sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Very excited about this week, and we have, I think, a first ballot genealogy Hall of Famer on the show for two segments today, Robert Charles Anderson, the man behind the Great Migration series for the last 25 to 30 years. And he's got so much to share with us about what's out there, what you can find now about your ancestors, and what he's learned about the Pilgrims. So we're going to get to that in about 8 or 9 minutes. And then, of course, later on in the show, our preservation authority, Tom Perry, will be back with some advice on how you can preserve your precious heirlooms. But right now we head to Boston for David Allen Lambert. He's our chief genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society and American Ancestors.org.
Happy day to you from Beantown, where I'm about 20 miles from where it all started.
You are, aren't you? I hadn't thought about that. By the way, if you ever go there and look at Plymouth Rock, I was just so bitterly disappointed, David. I'm a Mayflower descendant, but that rock is just way overstated.
I think it's all the people that were chipping away sections of it over the years for souvenirs. New Englanders were known for, let me take a piece of that with me.
Yeah, you might be right. Well, what do you have for us today?
This is an interesting story. You know, in the newspaper, occasionally you see ads for letters in the post office. You've probably seen, a search on your own family that maybe their name pops up. It's not exciting, but they get letters. And back in the day, you had to go and pick it up at the post office.
It's actually kind of disappointing because you look at it, you go, oh, there was a letter. What did it say? Who was it from? Where did it come from?
Or where did it go? Well, apparently in the Netherlands, a trunk that has been discovered that has over 2,600 undelivered letters that were written between 1680 and 1706.
Wow.
Have been come to light. They're being digitized right now, and they're from artists and merchants and even spies.
Cool.
And it's a project called Signed, Sealed, and Undelivered.
Right.
So it's amazing to think what could be in the context of these letters, and maybe some of our listeners are descended from the person who wrote the letter or the unfortunate person who never received it.
Right.
Out of the 2,600 letters, 600 of them are sealed, and they're going to use technology to x-ray or scan digitally and read what's in them and not break the wax seal. Maybe they're concerned with privacy. Going a little further west from the Netherlands to jolly old England, the Queen is getting involved with a DNA story that I think we remember chatting about.
Oh, the baronet?
It's interesting to think that the Queen has to get involved in a paternity event. But now with technology, we can turn to DNA to solve it. Apparently, this situation is that one person who is heir to the baronetcy of Stichel, which dates back to the 1680s, may be held by the wrong heir.
Uh-oh.
And so we have the oldest son, Simon, who's 56, expected to become the 11th baronet, until Murray Pringle, a 74-year-old accountant, claimed that he's the true heir, based upon DNA. So it's going through a process called the Judicial Committee Act, which has been seldom used since 1833. But the Queen has signed off a letter to have the investigation done.
With the DNA.
It turns out.
This is like Downton Abbey, modern style. I love it.
Exactly. Whatever the results are going to be music to somebody's ears. And that turns me to my next story, going out to the University of California, where they have taken the efforts to take over 10,000 songs from 19th century and early 20th century wax cylinders.
Oh, wow.
Run it to the Edison Records. And this is fascinating because we just don't know what is on these. And to think that people will be able to download them and listen to them. These are recordings of people from the 19th century whose great, 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 great grandchildren could probably hear them for the first time. And it's, of course, in the public domain.
Yes.
I'll also talk about the upcoming NEHDS free guest database. But before that, I wanted to mention a World War I database, which has just been launched this week by Scotland's People. .gov.uk. And this is the Military Service Appeals Tribunal records. Essentially, if you were between 18 and 41, you basically had to register for the draft because of England's involvement in World War I. This is over 7,900 individuals who claim that they had an exemption to not be part of the draft. Huh. And these records have been digitized. The index is free, and that's available online. I'm excited because I know that my wife's great-grandfather was in Dundee, Scotland back in the day. I know he didn't serve, so maybe I'll find out why.
Right, because you'd have to pay for the record, I assume, but it would give you the information about what was wrong with him.
Correct. And at least in this case on the index, you might know if you have the right person before you have to. It's kind of like test driving a car before you buy it, which I think is great with the indexes being out there.
There you go.
And of course, speaking of things like traveling, I just got back from Disney World with the family. And one of the things I like to think about is, now what do I do with everything? I've got my iPhone has photos. My digital camera has photos. How do I preserve them? What do you generally do with your pictures? Do you print them out? Do you do books?
Well, I like to, first of all, save them onto my desktop and then into at least two clouds so that they can't be lost, following Tom Perry's regular advice. Then I will put them together eventually in an album, maybe for the year, or maybe if it's a big enough event, you could make a separate book just for that event. That's what I like to do.
Yeah, I like the photo books that they produce now. They remind me of the days of the old photo corners and the black albums that people made back in the 19-teens and 20s. Technology is wonderful. And that brings me to our NEHS free guest user database on AmericanAncestors.org. And this week we are offering, in conjunction with FamilySearch.org, South African records. This includes Dutch Reformed Church registers from 1660 to 1970, as well as Free State Dutch Reformed Church records from 1848 to 1956. So a little gift from NEHGS and American Ancestors to all of our listeners.
All right. Great stuff, David. Thanks for coming on. We'll talk to you again next week. And if ever there was a first ballot genealogy Hall of Famer, my next guest has got to be one of them. His name is Robert Charles Anderson. He is the man behind the Great Migration series, and it is a series of incredible volumes tracing New England ancestry and how they link back to the old countries. And Bob Anderson, it is great to have you on the show, and an honor, sir.
Good to be here.
So you started this. Let's just get into that a little bit. Back in 1988, what inspired you to get this thing started?
The inspiration actually came probably in the mid-1970s when I was a relatively new genealogist. I'd been in a number of other academic disciplines, in biochemistry and in the military in electronics intelligence. And in those disciplines, I was accustomed to having up-to-date finding aids and reference works and so on. And in the mid-70s, when I got interested in genealogy and started to train myself, I discovered that all the reference works, or most of the reference works that I had to deal on, were 100 years old and more.
Right.
I mean, the Genealogical Dictionary of New England by James Savage, which is still valuable, was published during the Civil War. And in academia or a technical area, that would be unacceptable. Furthermore, as I developed my genealogical practice in the late 70s and early 80s, I just got frustrated with the difficulty of not having one place to go to find out what research had already been done on a given family. So it was out of that that I conceived the idea of the Great Migration Study Project, of creating a single reference work that would provide a platform that current researchers could build from.
And that is going to be the case, obviously, for decades and centuries to come, and hopefully it will continue on. I'm just looking at the list here. We've got the Great Migration Directory, the Great Migration Begins, covering the immigrants to New England from 1620 to 1633, immigrants to New England 1634 to 35, the Pilgrim Migration, which we're going to get into here in a minute, the Winthrop Fleet, Massachusetts Bay Company immigrants to New England 1629 to 30. I mean, it's an astonishing accomplishment and series. And you continue on today. How much more is there to find, Bob?
Immense amounts. Two of the items you mentioned, the Great Migration Begins, which is three volumes, and then the Great Migration volumes that cover 1634 and 5, which is seven volumes, cover less than half of the Great Migration. They cover three quarters chronologically, but less than half by numbers of immigrants.
Wow.
So there are, in the directory, my most recent book, I conclude that there are roughly 5,600 either families or isolated individuals, and that's a minimum number. I was very conservative, including people. And I had done about 2,300 of those in the in the 10 volumes I mentioned. So there's 3,300 left to be done. Now, it's taken me 25 years to do what I've done, and so someone is going to have to pick up someday and do the rest. I won't be doing those other volumes.
Right.
I'll be doing special projects henceforth. But, and then even that, within the 5,600, for only 1,800 of those do we know the English origin. And so there's immense, even with the volumes that I've completed, there's immense amount of work to be done yet in discovering English origins to complete the picture of the Great Migration.
Well, it's an invaluable resource for anybody who gets going in genealogy, and people need to be aware of it if they're not already. Let's talk about the Pilgrim Migration. Tell us a little about that, some things that we may not know that you discovered in your research.
Let me say, first of all, that although I do some original research for these books, the primary purpose, as I say, is to review previous research and to provide the platform for people to do additional research. The Pilgrim Migration volume was published in 2004, and it's actually an updating of sketches that I did in the Great Migration Begins series a decade earlier. The Great Migration Begins series had covered all of New England from 1620 to 1633. And that obviously comprehends the Mayflower and the other Leyden and associated arrivals who came through the rest of the decade. So what I did to create the Pilgrim Migration volume was to take the 200 and some odd sketches that I'd done in the mid-1990s and updated them and improved them a little bit because I was still learning on those first volumes how to do it and so on. What did I discover? I would have to think about that. My best discoveries are finding patterns.
Right.
And, you know, the Pilgrim area has been mined so deeply. You know, we always think of New England in general as being the most heavily mined area of genealogical research in this country for the first period. And within that, the Pilgrim and Mayflower area is dug into the most. So I think my work in this volume was really to put in one place what previous people had done. Also, one of the things that I do in my volumes is try to get rid of old myths. You know, it's the case that once something gets in print, it's almost impossible to kill it.
Oh, it's even worse now with the internet.
Exactly. And so I tried very hard to look into every claim, and, you know, many of these claims are romantic stories that pop up in the 19th century and need to be beaten down. It's not one of my discoveries, certainly, but it's timely. One of the stories that popped up in the Mayflower community in the 19th century was that when the Mayflower arrived off of Cape Cod at Provincetown, one of the first people to die was William Bradford's wife, Dorothy.
Yes.
She died while the ship was in Provincetown Harbor before they'd even, other than a few of the men, anyone had gone on shore. And somehow in the 19th century, a myth popped up that she had committed suicide.
Yes, I've seen that.
Right. And two researchers in the 20th century, George Ernest Bowman, who founded the journal Mayflower Descendant, and Eugene Stratton, who wrote one of the better books on Plymouth Colony, both worked very carefully to show that that was just the imagination of someone in the 19th century. And so I was careful to include the statements made by Bowman and Stratton. Someone has once described my work as clearing away the underbrush, getting rid of all the myths and the misstatements, again, to provide that sound platform for future research. And I should say, just for the moment, I think a number of your listeners will have the opportunity to see two films on the Mayflower, on the Pilgrims and the Mayflower. One called Saints and Strangers, which is being filmed on the National Geographic Channel, and the other, whose title I don't know, but it's going to be on PBS. And I had the pleasure of seeing an advanced filming of the Saints and Strangers story a few nights ago. And I have to say that they were very careful in not continuing that myth about Dorothy Bradford. They handled it very carefully and very cleverly. So it's good to see that maybe my work and Gene's and George Bowman's work has had some effect.
Isn't that great that you can at this point? Yeah. Because it does make you wonder how in the world you ever get rid of some of the things that are out there. There's just so many volumes and volumes of it. But that's where your credibility becomes such an important thing, and you certainly achieved that. When you think about the Pilgrims and Thanksgiving, how does that affect your Thanksgiving now? Because you've got to feel like you know them probably better than anybody else on the planet.
Well, I wouldn't say that. There's other people who've studied the Pilgrim story more closely than I have, such as Jeremy Bangs at the Leiden Museum and people like that. But and I do think back, and I do think about it. Now, Thanksgiving, you know, is we have a very particular image of it here in our culture, but it was a standard feature of the Protestant Church in England and of the Puritan Church. It wasn't just a once-a-year thing. It was something that they could proclaim any time they felt the need to, any time they felt that something good had happened. So it wasn't just limited to one time a year in the culture of the time. It's portrayed as such now. Now that I've seen that film, the Saints and Strangers film, have seen what the Pilgrims went through in that first winter of 1620 and 1621 and into the summer. It was a starving time. It was a time, you know, half and more of the passengers died and so on. And they were, of course, in an area that they knew nothing about, really, and surrounded by the natives who didn't really want them there. It's just astounding that they, A, would do it, and B, that they really did survive and built something out of it, even with all of that. So it makes you more appreciative, not just for the Pilgrims, but for all of our ancestors who made the sacrifices to give us what we have now.
And for the natives and all that they endured to accommodate the Europeans as they came aboard.
Yes. The Indians in New England had just suffered a terrible death by various infectious diseases in the years just before the Pilgrims arrived. And that those infectious diseases were undoubtedly brought by sailors and fishermen of the previous decade or so. So it wasn't pleasant for any of them.
I am Fisher with my special guest, Robert Charles Anderson, the man behind the Great Migration series. Volumes and volumes and decades of work in bringing together the records of those earliest ancestors that came to New England, the Pilgrims, and then those who followed. What year are you up to right now, Robert?
Well, the volumes in which I have tried to treat each individual extensively go from the Mayflower in 1620 until 1635. And the Great Migration itself essentially ended in 1640 with the coming of the English Civil War, at which point the Puritans felt that they might be able to attain their religious goals back in England rather than have to be away from England.
Hmm.
And so the migration pretty much stopped in 1640. So there's 5 years left to be done, 1636 through 1640, but just because the pace of the migration was uneven over the period, very little in the 1620s, picked up in the early 1630s, and then went full steam from about 1634 to 1640, most of the work remains to be done. It would take probably another dozen volumes of the size of the previous ones, of 600 pages each or so, to cover the remaining passengers the way I would like to have it done.
Do you work with a team or are you on your own?
I'm pretty much on my own. I've had assistants from time to time and a couple of people I worked with at the middle stages. But one of the values, I believe, of my project is that it filters everything through one mind.
Yes.
If that makes any sense.
It does.
That is to say, it gives it a continuity and a consistency of approach.
And a voice, I would think.
And a voice. And it also, if you had a team working on it, even if there was a top editor who went over everything, one of the problems with a huge project like this is using the same bit of evidence for two different people, which it would be impossible to apply, let's say, a freemanship record or a church admission for a John Smith and apply it to two different men of the same name and so on. And having one person do it doesn't eliminate that totally, but it helps cut that back. So, I'm just an independent kind of guy, and it has worked better for me over the years.
I'm not sure that many people recognize the significance of the Winthrop fleet and what took place there? Because that was where it picked up after the 1620s. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, absolutely. Of course, the Pilgrims only brought 100 people, and half of those died the first year.
Right.
And they picked up a few dozen more over the 1620s as more of their Leiden congregation came piecemeal, and a few fishing communities sprung up. But there really wasn't that much, only a few hundred in the whole of the 1620s. And it's in 1630 when the Winthrop fleet came, which was about 1,000 individuals, to Massachusetts Bay rather than further south to Plymouth, that the whole project of English colonization became much stronger and much more massive. And then after that, after a couple of slow years for the last 6 or 7 years of the 1630s, people were coming at 2,000 or 3,000 a year. And so the Winthrop fleet solidified the settlement process and laid the foundation for even bigger things.
How many ships in the fleet and how often did they come?
Well, in the Winthrop fleet, there were four main passenger vessels led by the Arbella, which is the famous ship that's always
yes.
mentioned. There were seven other ships that sailed just behind them, organized by the same group, that were more laden with provisions and cattle, although there were a few passengers there. Then there was the Mary and John, which was a separate operation that came out of Weymouth, with the Dorchester contingent on it, which was Puritan also, but organized by a different group. And then there were a smattering of smaller vessels set out by independent merchants of a Puritan persuasion. So there were about 17 vessels in all, and we think about 1,000 people, plus their provisions and other things.
So they would all come at the same time?
Pretty much the same time. Passenger vessels didn't want to be on the North Atlantic in the middle of the winter.
Right.
And so they generally sat at London or one of the smaller outports in England in April and May and gathered their passengers and provisions and then would set sail sometime in May. And a crossing was generally 8 weeks plus or minus a bit. And so they would begin to arrive in June and July and August and so on. And then the arrivals would tail off after that. In 1631, 32, and 33, there was much smaller migration. But then from 1634 to 1640, there were probably 20 vessels every spring who would line up in London or Yarmouth or somewhere and bring passengers over. And that went on for 6 or 7 years.
That had to be quite the sight for people waiting on the east coast of North America, looking out to sea when suddenly these masts start to show over the horizon.
Right. And one of the things that amazes me is that specifically in 1634, and remember I said that there were 1,000 in the Winthrop fleet, and then in 31, 32, and 33, there may be only a few hundred more. Even in that time period, you have fewer than 2,000, I would say. And then some of those died and some went back. So the whole population of New England, even including the Plymouth people, was 2,000 to 2,500.
Wow.
The pace picked up in April of 1634. That many people arrived. So in a space of 6 weeks, the English population of New England doubled.
Wow. And then at the same time, of course, there was a populating going on in the New Amsterdam area by the Dutch.
That's correct.
And down in the Virginia area as well. But still, I mean, the population was so small. I mean, by 1650, where were we? For the European population.
For New England, this would be a rough guess. I would say 30 or 40,000.
I mean, we could fit the entire European population into a small college football stadium.
That's right.
Unbelievable.
Yes. And they were spread from the main coast all the way down to, Stamford, Connecticut, basically.
Mm-hmm. So now you're continuing on. How many more years do you still think you have in you to do this?
However many years it is, it won't be at the same pace as the last 25, I can assure
sure.
you of that. But I'm hoping about 10 more years that I can keep going. I've got a book in the works right now that builds on the directory. The directory is a straightforward reference work. It's three or four lines devoted to each individual immigrant. And my next book that's going to take me the next 2 years or so is a narrative history of the origins of the Great Migration. I'm calling it Puritan Pedigrees, the deep roots of the Great Migration to New England. Then I'll take it all the way back into the reign of Henry VIII and show how the network of ministers and laymen who made up the Great Migration came together over the century from the 1530s to the 1630s.
Are you finding it's easier to research now because of more material being made available online?
Somewhat. The problem is, and it's my problem and not anyone else's problem, is that all the commercial outfits that are putting so much in, online, and even the nonprofits, for very good reasons, have focused on the 19th century with all the censuses and sure. all the immigration records and so on. And that makes perfect sense because that covers a larger portion of the population and gets at some of the difficult areas. And so the amount of material that's been put online for the 17th century, both here and in England, is not as much as for the 19th century, but it's getting to be more and more. Some of it is very beautiful. For instance, the Essex Record Office in England has a site called SEAX, S-E-A-X. It's a subscription site, but not that expensive. And within the last few years, they've beautifully, beautifully in color imaged all their parish registers. And so I could just sit at home and work with all of the Essex parish registers to my delight and not have to go to England for that particular job. So it's getting better.
Well, it's great work, and you're creating a legacy for yourself as well as for all these people, and we thank you for it. Robert Charles Bob Anderson, he is the man behind The Great Migration. And if you haven't checked out the series, you don't know about it, you need to learn about it. Find out more online, of course, through NEHGS as well. Thank you so much for coming on, Bob.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
And coming up next, Tom Perry, our preservation authority on how to preserve those damaged VHS tapes. You know, Tom, I have come to the conclusion that preservation is like a big swamp.
That's so true.
It is just full of all kinds of stuff, trying to deal with saving stuff and fixing stuff. Hi, it's Fisher. You're at Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And that's Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, our preservation authority. And we're going to talk about damaged stuff and how you preserve it and how you get it back to where it's functional, especially videos. And there are so many of the old ones that we'd really like to enjoy now and see what we looked like back in the day, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. We had those big honking video cameras.
Oh, absolutely.
But some of those tapes are damaged, and it can be expensive and time consuming to fix them. What is your best advice?
The best advice is don't throw anything out. We have had people bring stuff into us. It's just crazy. And what am I going to do for, you know, my kids? What am I going to do for my grandkids for Christmas? The absolute best thing you can give them is memories that they will be able to use forever and ever and ever. You buy them a new widescreen TV. Oh, wow, that's cool. But what's it going to mean to them in 3 years from now? It's going to mean nothing. And it's like, you know, the swamp monster that you described is coming out with all this green stuff hanging off of him. And that's how some of your tapes look, whether they've been
right.
through heat problems, water problems. But there's so many things. Sometimes they just sit there and they fall apart. Back in the day when you bought VHS tapes or Betamax tapes, you look at a tape. Hey, this one's $5. This one's $3. Well, duh, I'm going to buy the $3 one. Well, 9 out of 10 times, there's a reason that one was only $3.
Mm.
And most of the tapes that we get in that are damaged, the first thing that happens to them is a little clear plastic at the end of it, it snaps off the hub. And once that's off the hub, you can't do anything with it. The worst thing you can do is, if you don't know what to do, is opening it. Because once you open it, there's springs, there's all kinds of little dills in there. And if they get caught into the tape, we've had that happen. Somebody said, oh, I can fix this myself. They popped it open. One of the little aluminum things got set back into the tape. They didn't know it. And then as they start playing the tape starts getting wider and wider at that point until it doesn't fit in the case anymore and starts scratching the tape and actually tore the tape into pieces. It's heartbreaking, you know, to have stuff like that. It's heartbreaking. So what you need to do is either send it to us, find somebody that really knows how to fix VHS tapes. If you're a little bit scared about sending it off to us, be very, very, very careful. How you want to open them is flip them upside down, very carefully get a grease pencil or a China marker and mark where the screws are so you'll remember where they go.
Right.
Because there's a lot of holes in the bottom of a case where different equipment goes through to tell the tape, oh, it's this kind of a tape, this is what I need to rewind, da-da-da-da-da. And you might put the screws in the wrong place and lose your screw in there and cause all kinds of problems. So just mark with a China marker where all the screws are, then gently take them out. Make sure you have the right size screwdriver. You don't want to strip them out either, because you can't run to the hardware store and buy screws for a VHS tape. And then what you want to do is just very carefully take out all the screws, then hold the top and the bottom together and flip it over, and then lift off the top very, very carefully. Okay, now once you've done that, set that down with the top basically upside down in front of it. and then see where your tape is and pull out your tape. And I recommend you wear white gloves or something like that so you don't damage the tape or get your fingerprints all over it. And take the tape out and get a good razor blade or scissors or whatever and kind of overlap it a bit. So when you cut it on about a 45-degree angle, the two pieces will fold back together.
So this is like old-fashioned editing.
Exactly.
With tape, yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's what we were raised on. We were raised on razor blade and tape.
Yes, they called me Dr. Blade back in the day.
That's great.
Because I was good at it.
Exactly. So it wasn't you were a rollerblader or a roller skater.
No.
So that's what you want to do, and you want to make sure you get a good quality tape. You want it only half inch. You want it the exact same size as your tape. And basically, when a tape goes into a machine, it's the outside part of the tape that actually comes in contact with the heads. So it's best to put the tape on the other side, and we'll go into a little bit more detail of exactly how to do this.
All right, it's on Extreme Jeans, America's Family History Show. This is Tom Perry over here. He's our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com, and we're talking about repairing your own VHS tapes, which sounds like a very dangerous operation.
Oh, it is. You know, if you're not good at putting models together, and as you mentioned, making different things as a youngster, this is something you don't want to take on. It seems simple, but we have more people cause more damage than if they would have just brought it to us. It's like the old saying at the auto play store. If you bring your car in to have something fixed, it's this much an hour. If you watch, it's this much more an hour. If you help, it's even this much more an hour. If you started on it before you brought it up, then it's even really expensive.
Sure, that makes sense. And you don't want to take it to just anybody to fix it, too. Personally, I wasn't very good at some of the things you talked about. But I'm not going to take it to some kid who's just out of high school at a big box store. Oh, yeah, I can fix your tape, Mr. Fisher.
Oh,
no,
exactly.
I don't think so. We need to find the local person who's been doing it for decades, as you've done.
Exactly.
But if other people are saying I can do this, where do we proceed from where we left off in the last segment?
Okay, so what you want to do is, like I told you, get a good quality tape. If you don't buy editing tape online off of Amazon or something, find the right kind of splicing tape. Otherwise, you need to go to a good quality tape that you can get from an art store, but make sure it's half-inch tape if you're using VHS or Beta, because if it's wider or narrower, it's not going to work right. And as I was mentioning in the last segment, you want to kind of flip it over and tape it on the back side, not on the front side. If you do it on the front side, it's not catastrophe. It'll still work. Just be really, really careful with it, because the problem is it comes in contact with the heads inside the VCR. And if it grabs on them, it can damage your heads. And once your heads are gone, you know what it's like trying to find a brand new VHS machine today.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
So you want to be really careful with that. And make sure when you're cutting the tape, you cut it with the scissors. Don't use that jagged thing that comes on a tape dispenser, because that just added like 6 or 7 more ways to catch your heads and damage your heads or get caught on something.
Right. Good point.
And so be really careful. You don't want to overlap the tape. You want to put the tape right together. And one thing that kind of works, because a lot of times the tapes will fold and I can't get it to lay flat to put the tape on it. Get a Q-tip or any kind of cotton swab and some isopropyl alcohol and get just a little bit on the Q-tip and put it on the desk where you're doing the editing. And then with your gloves on, just push the tape down to that. And that alcohol will hold the tape flat long enough for you to put the tape on, rub the tape really well. And then when you pull it up, the alcohol will just dissipate and it'll evaporate and it'll be great.
Good tip.
The higher the alcohol content, the better. Don't get this cheap dollar store stuff that's 50-50. You want to make sure it's 75% or higher. One thing that helps a lot is take pictures of your case as you take things apart. Take a picture, take out another part, take a picture, take out another part. Because if you're like a lot of us that are visual, you'll see, okay, where did this piece go? Go
right
back to your picture and look. So take pictures as you go, because then that will show you how to wrap it around. Because you'll say, okay, there's all these little cylinder things. Does it go inside this one or outside this one? The little rubber thing, does it go inside this, outside this? Take pictures, and then you can go back and look at it. And so just very carefully set the thing down. Don't force it. If the top doesn't go back on very smoothly, something's out of alignment. Take it back off, look at your picture, and find out, oh, whoops, there's a spring missing. And that will also keep you from getting things caught in the hubs, that when you try to rewind it or fast forward it, it's going to shred your tapes.
So at the end of this whole thing, you've got pictures of it. You know how it goes. You know how it fits. You want to put it all back together just as it was, and hopefully it works out, but it sounds like it's quite a risky operation.
Oh, it is. Do not try this with VHS-Cs. Don't try this with mini DVs. Don't try this with video 8s unless you really, really know what you're doing.
All right. Great stuff. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
See you next week. And that wraps it up for this week. Thanks for joining us. And thanks once again to Robert Charles Anderson, the man behind the Great Migration series, for coming on and talking about the Pilgrims and the Puritans. If you missed it, make sure you catch our podcast. Talk to you next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.